So I've been struggling at various times with sleepiness while trying to meditate, having the intention of being present and aware and finding myself dozing off. At a retreat last year, the first several days were like that. And early one morning, I found myself doing something similar to your knowing and letting go. It was kind of like I was doing an allow and release of the hypnagogic imagery that was coming up for me. And so it was like I was sitting dreaming and allowing each rather elaborate imagery to take place and then letting it go. I'm not always able to do that. Sometimes I'm just nodding off. And I do wonder about the kind of the skillful means. Like, is it better just to take a nap if I'm that sleepy? Or does one kind of struggle with it in terms of maintaining one's intention to be aware and present?
Yeah, I mean, where we pay attention to the causes, in the sense that, yeah, sometimes when we show up at a retreat, a lot of times people are fried. You know, it's just, you've been really hectic and busy and, really tired. And sometimes it's not even sort of so much, it's not even acknowledged so much as how clear, how much that is. And so that sometimes it's actually fine to just relax, have a sleep, get some rest, and then get a fresh start. Because it's the hindrance of sloth and torpor, as opposed to the experience of sloth and torpor, in the sense that because there's different reasons why we experience sloth and torpor. And sometimes it's just, we're just really tired and we need a rest. So that being able to acknowledge that and to give that. Because otherwise we tend to be, sometimes we can overcome it, but to take it on consciously just as an experiment sometimes is kind of interesting. But sometimes the results are good and sometimes the results aren't so good. Especially when one has, as a lay person, and the retreat time, it can be sometimes limited, 10 days, 2 weeks. And then coming from duties and work and family and whatnot, sometimes you're just tired and need to sleep. So it's probably sometimes it's a more useful, a better use of like a retreat time, to begin by having a rest and then starting fresh. But it is an interesting thing to experiment with, because sometimes the tiredness or sleep so much of it is can oftentimes be just not wanting to exist for a while. I just need a break. I don't want to have to deal with this. I just sleep. As a habit, it's not a skillful habit. So that's where sloth and torpor starts to come in, you're actually well rested. The mind is required to be still and quiet, and it just doesn't want to be there. And it, rather than, sometimes we have different defense mechanisms like that will we go off into restless fantasies and proliferations is one. It depends on temperament, and at other times, or we'll go into that just sloth and torpor. Mind doesn't want to do it. Just tires. I don't want to deal. Go into oblivion or into a. But there's also a kind of how do you say a with sloth and torpor. That kind of liminal sort of state of not quite awake, not quite asleep, and it's sort of peaceful, but there's nothing much happening. and it feels kind of good. So there's a certain attractiveness to it. And it's easy to, and it doesn't take many effort either, so, which is kind of good as well. So, we have to be able to, that sense of giving instruction, lifting up the mind to the object, lifting up the mind to something pleasing or bright. And then it gains that momentum, and it actually stays bright. I've seen monks work with, when they're actually really, really tired, and I remember one time watching this monk. One of the things we do at Ajahn Chah's monastery. When it comes to at the end of the rains retreat, when we've done retreats, and then there's many branch monasteries, and after the rains retreat, there's a ceremony, a robe offering ceremony, that's a katina, but the way it's done at Ajahn Chah's monastery is people will gather on the day before. And then in the night there'll be chanting, short period of meditation, and then there'll be Dhamma talks through the whole night. And then the offering takes place the next day. So, you stay up meditating, listen to Dhamma talks, and then the next day. But sometimes, because there's many branch, this is one branch monastery, but sometimes you'll have two or three of them in a row. And it can get tiring. And I can remember watching one, because he was, they were helping, it was actually Ajahn Chah's teacher. They were helping him and his ceremony. And he came back, and then it was at Ajahn Chah's monastery. So he'd been 2 or 3 days without sleep, or maybe snatches here or there, and then he was sitting in the hall, and I knew he was tired, and then he would in his yes, and he'd pull himself up, and then he just sat there. And I thought, God, this guy's incredible. If it were me, I know what I'd do. I'd find a quiet place somewhere and I'd crash out. He just kept doing it. It was, from about 10 o'clock at night through to about 1. And it was like 3 hours just pulling himself up. And then I saw him at about 1 o'clock just pull himself up again. And then he just sat pretty bolt upright till the morning chanting at 4 o'clock. It's really amazing. It was just because he'd just worked with it and was willing to keep applying effort. And there's tiredness or sloth and torpor. This is not pleasant. but taking it on just as a training. It's not how you live your life. It's not how you do it. But sometimes experiment, because that that kind of, so the boundaries that we set for ourselves are oftentimes much smaller than we can actually deal or work with or be with, from time to time, learning from that it's a real learning.
So even if we're nodding off, we can still be attempting to apply ourselves.
We can still keep attempting to apply ourselves. Yeah.
Thank you.
Bhante, there's a film out that came out recently called Monk with a Camera.
Oh, I heard about it.
Well, I thought you might have.
I haven't seen that. Yeah,
it's about a Mahayana monk, a Tibetan monk. So the question, though, is about desire, contentment, relinquishment. This is an American-born monk who grew up in luxury, became a Tibetan monk, but he maintained his love of photography. And in fact, his photography served him all through his monastic time as well. I won't go into the details, but the question is really about for all the artists in this room, and I know there are at least two and probably many more, finding this balance between pursuing one's artistic interests, be it musical, literary, visual, whatever, and still having and following a path sincerely, a path of relinquishment. I don't know of any Theravada artists. I don't know if that's a... I know there are plenty of Zen monks who are poets and were certainly traditionally way back. But could you speak a little bit about relinquishment and just enough relinquishment,
right,
if you will, in this context of having other interests that are actually feeding?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a case to be made from stepping back from the things that we love and identify with as our kind of persona, and similarly with some of our artistic pursuits, stepping back from them so we can get a bigger perspective. And I'll give an example of some people may know him. Reverend Hung Shuer is a disciple of Master Hua from City of 10,000 Buddhas. He's been a monk now for almost 40 years. And he was a musician. As a layperson, I would expect probably quite a good musician. And he set aside his music. I guess maybe after about 25 years or so, 25 to 30 years, about 10 or so years ago, he picked it up again. He's incredibly talented. So he's a good songwriter. So he's written some very good songs. So Dhamma themes, he's developing a repertoire for, because a lot of it was just reaching out. It was a way to connect with people. And then he was asked to do a recording. He had the opportunity to record some of his stuff. So then he, and each time as he performs, and as part of his practice, is to be investigating how much self and identity is going into this, and then with the recordings, then he, because he got into a studio with, and he was, you know, he really took it as practice. But then when he went into the studio, had a couple other very good musicians who were supporting him, and then. After the recordings were done, he went back and listened to them, and there was about three of the songs. He said, those are unacceptable, because he could hear his voice. There's a particular, and he explained it to me. He said, there's a way that you use your voice that's a hook, to try to hook people, to bring them in. He said, it's performers use it all the time, and it's part of performing. But he said, I said it was just deeply embarrassing to hear him utilizing that hook, because it was, and he was going out of a place of focus and non-self, and that self was looking for a hook to grab people by and be gratified. So he's really learning from it, I think that's a good example of how to use it for Dhamma practice. We have several former musicians in our community, but you know, we're pretty stodgy, so.
There's
a one of our community, Ajahn Sona. He was named Sona because Sona was the former musician, and so that he's got a master's degree from Berklee Music School. So he's good, but he's very conscious of that. Okay, that's a past persona, and he's puts his energy and his effort into teaching, and he is a really skilled teacher, incredible storyteller. Visual arts are in Theravada a lot more, easily translated into the lifestyle. Sort of one of our monks his university degree was in fine art, so he has an interest, and he's been experimenting in different ways, and a lot of it using painting and quilting, because his mother was a quilter, so that he sort of learned that, and using things with images of religious images, peaceful images, experimenting with that. And so he's always got paintings to give away to people. And he finds a lot of joy in that. And he also gets energized by it. He says it's really interesting. He says he really has to set an alarm clock if it's at nighttime when he's doing it. And he doesn't allow himself to paint past midnight, because he'll lose track of time. But it's something that he enjoys, and it's something that he enjoys giving to other people, and certainly people enjoy receiving it. Those aspects of he realizing it's a devotional practice that is in. And last year, our next door neighbors are a Catholic monastery. They're Catholic Uniates, Orthodox rite. The abbot of the monastery now is a master icon painter, and he leads classes in icon painting. He's very good. He's a very good person as well as a good painter. He invited us if we wanted to take any of his classes. So two of our monks went over and did this class in icon painting, because he was interested to see how to that interface, and maybe some of the imagery could be translatable into a classical Western model. So some of his Buddhas have seraphims around them.
Hi. Thank you for being here today. Let's see. I'm interested in asking about perfectionism and the, well, a lot of my life has been based on guilt, punishment, achievement, feeling driven. And a lot of maybe I'll get there someday, perfectionism, and deeply woven into practice. And very fortunately, recently, and highly coincidentally, I experienced the reverse of that. I didn't expect it. I was working hard to be, you know, approvable, and somebody just said, "You do wonderful." It turned me on myself and said, "Look, you know, I thought I knew it was for me, but he knew better. He knew that I wasn't just on my own side." So he turned me, if this is making sense, turned me back on me and said, "Look, you've done really beautiful work, and it wasn't what I was expecting." Mm-hmm. So I'm learning to live. I'm moving in this transition, which is really lovely. And I also still get very reactive, very driven by the old perfectionistic behavior, which is very harsh. And I don't always know how to, except to be here all day. And maybe that's the answer, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It could easily be, or maybe not so easily, but... Yeah. I'd really like it if you would respond in terms of, for years I've gotten, or I've had, how do I say, you know, like perfectionism seems so great, you know, it's like, yeah, why not? Yeah. And having that mixed up with wholesome desire and just being in such a whirl trying to be content. So thank you.
Yeah, I think that that sense of paying attention to the results, because on a rational level, it seems that getting things perfect or getting it perfectly done or getting the perfect thing, whatever it is, should be satisfying. And fulfilling, but it isn't. And that area of contentment is so important, of being able to, to be content with ourselves. Yeah, recognizing that pattern of guilt that follows us, because it's so much of it is around our how we perceive our sense of self, because our sense of self is lacking, and it needs something else, something other, and of course, it's impossible to feel. There's a great exchange I had one time with. I was traveling as a translator for a a Thai, very senior Thai monk. We were in New Zealand and teaching, and he was at an evening chanting, meditation, Dhamma talk, and then the questions after. And one of the questions was, you know, what do I do? You know, how do I work with guilt? And then I went to translate the question, and then I burst out laughing because I didn't know what the word for guilt was in Thai. I'd been translating for some time. I'd been living there for quite some time, but I didn't know what it wasn't because it wasn't familiar. And so then what I had to do was explain to this senior Thai monk what a Westerner does to make themselves feel guilty. And then and he listened, and he had this very concerned look on his face. I said, oh, that's really suffering. Tell them not to do that. It's just such a foreign concept for him. So I think it's helpful to realize that it's not actually intrinsic to us as in our human condition. It's something that we add to it, and we've got alternatives. Okay, maybe one last question.
John, thank you for this wonderful talk, and I really appreciated it. I wanted to ask you about the word anatta, and one of the translations of that I heard was not being in control. Of course, there's also the translation of non-self, but I heard that that things happen by itself and not being in control is one of the descriptions I heard of that. So I wanted to just ask you in relation to the concept of desire, whether it's the intention or the desire, whether that's a natural unfolding that happens, that, and whether do we really have any choice or free will in when it happens. I just wanted to put it in the context of Buddhist understanding of.
I mean, from a Buddhist perspective, say like metta as being not being in control. I haven't.
Sorry, I was talking about anatta.
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 Anatta. Well, it's not so much being, not being in control. Well, yeah. Maybe outside of our control, but in the sense that things are following a natural pattern, but those natural patterns are affected by us, so that we definitely make choices, and that's the reason why it's so important to educate our desire and desire systems, because we do make choices all the time. And those choices have a result. And we reap the fruits of those results, whether we're conscious or not conscious, whether we're we understand what we're doing or not, we're constantly making choices. So again, that's understanding the process whereby we do make those choices, and then we can exercise some control. It isn't in the sense of control, as a control freak, or as I'm going to get what I want finally, and what I want is enlightenment. it's just not going to work that way. But the reality is we have to bring that conscious clarity so that we're able to take responsibility for ourselves and to really affect our own being and the beings around us in a positive way. We have that opportunity. Otherwise, it's just kind of random, it's real hit and miss. So trying to make that more clear, more conscious.
John, if I can just ask one, do we have control over the arising of desire?
Absolutely. In the sense of, if we understand clearly, and if we see that, and it's not really thought out, it's just understood. Every time I've tried to fulfill that desire, I have felt frustrated. And I finally get it, so that that's where that sense of a relinquishment is around. And it also comes to a point, and I mean, it's interesting, from the Buddhist perspective, because one of the word in the Four Noble Truths, there's there's dukkha, there's suffering, there's the cause of dukkha, there's the cessation of dukkha, there's the path leading to cessation. And when we think in terms of, and it's hard to find a translation from the part Nirodha, that is cessation, because yes, there is a cessation, but our assumption, and it isn't just in the Thai language is exactly the same, though I think it's as a human being, our assumption of a cessation is an arisen thing coming to cessation, so that what was there is not going to be there. So then cessation of suffering or cessation of desire, we have it, and then we have to somehow make it disappear. But the nuance, and I think it's a really important nuance, when the Buddha speaks of cessation, another way of looking at it is non-arising, so that and that's equally valid translation. There's suffering, there's the cause of suffering, there's the non-arising of suffering, and there's the path leading to its non-arising, and that's a different relationship. And it's really important to get the feel for that. When we live in a certain way, it isn't that we make suffering cease. It's not arising.
Thank you so much.
Okay, let's have a little bit, end the day, it's 4:30, wind it up, in-breath, out-breath, do it mindfully.